The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us today on our podcast about anecdotes from practicing interventional spine. These topics are designed to be casual discussions about differences in practice. We hope you all enjoy learning from your colleagues who express their reasoning why they do what they do in this podcast series. I'm your host, Dr. Renee Rosati. Today's guest is Dr. Renee Enriquez. She's an assistant professor at the Multidisciplinary Spine Center in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. So thanks for joining us, Renee. It's so fun to have another Renee on the podcast.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Renee. I never call anybody by their first name, Dr. Renee or so forth, but I think with you, I'm going to do that because
I love to have people just introduce themselves. So if you could first tell us about your practice and how many patients do you see a day? What's your patient population? What is your favorite thing to treat?
So my practice, which I enjoy very much at UT Southwest, is a mix between sports and spine. And when I say mix, it's almost probably a 50% mix between use of ultrasound and fluoroscopic guided type of procedures. The patient population I see ranges from, young adult 18 up to, as old as we can get, 100 years old. UT Southwest has a multidisciplinary spine center, and that's where I predominantly work out of. In the spine center, we do get referrals for spine pathology, but I also get other musculoskeletal issues with pathologies, which I have to treat, which we know we commonly see when treating spine. Those patients can range from anything from, hip osteoarthritis to cervical radiculopathy to coccyx pain to, patellar tendon injury. Outside of, evaluation and conservative care and treatment, I do mostly interventional procedures. Again, that's about 50% ultrasound guided and 50% fluoroscopic guided procedures. I am RMSK certified, which means that I had sat for the exam for sonographed to be certified in reading and utilizing ultrasound for MSK muscular pathology. The practice I have is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So we do get a very diverse population. So not only diverse in age, but diverse in socioeconomic status, diverse in race. It's a great place to practice. I really enjoy practicing here.
That's wonderful. And tell us a little bit about what you do for fun outside of the office.
So a passion for me outside of the office and also in my clinical practice is exercise. I love physical activity. I think it's the fountain of youth. And so I try to be as physically active as possible. I like to practice yoga. I am an avid runner and that's probably where my heart lies. Weight training is always important. And I like to take this approach of, constant physical activity and provide that information, that education to my patients. So for instance, after I do a radio frequency ablation and I say, oh, your back pain's better. Now we're going to talk about the exercise. What are we going to do? So I don't have to repeat this radio frequency ablation. And I probably just had that conversation about 20 minutes ago before we started this.
Well, it sounds like you practice what you preach. And I love that. So today's topic is really interesting. And it's something that I asks myself all the time. It's when a patient comes to you with cervical pain, myofascial cervical pain, or like pain in the trapezius muscle, and they really want an injection in their neck. What do you tell them about their prognosis? And do you end up giving them an injection, whether it be epidural or trigger point?
So neck pain is very interesting. Obviously, we have to figure out what's the source of the problem. So it could be anything from chronic muscular pain, from overuse syndrome, poor posturing, our chronic life of chronic overuse syndromes, use of technology, tech neck, as we like to call it. We're all on the phones and we're all on our computers all the time. So, it could be something very benign. And when I say benign, I mean nothing that, we'd ever do surgery for. And that's, myofascial pain. But pain in the trapezius or pain in that region, which I call posterior neck pain, posterior shoulder pain, scapular pain, even thoracic pain, that can be an array of other things as well. So not only muscular pain, but it can also be referral from musculoskeletal pain, say a shoulder problem, an intra-articular shoulder problem. Bring it back to the spine, the cervical spine and the thoracic spine can refer in similar patterns. The thoracic spine can give periscapular pain, and so can the cervical spine, depending on the source of the pain. So for instance, we know we have dermatomal patterns of pain, right? Which is we constantly think if we have a dermatomal, if we have a altered sensation and it's, you know, decreased sensation, weakness or pain in the posterior shoulder, could it be an upper cervical radiculopathy? Possibly. But it's not only always a pinched nerve. Could it be a dynatomal pattern that we're seeing? Is it a facet mediated pain presentation that we're seeing? So that dynatomal or facet mediated pain pattern that we see on the patient can also kind of represent what you'd say that trapezial pain. I want to go back to that word trapezial, by the way, because if you think about the trapezius, it is a huge muscle. It starts from the occipital protuberance. It goes all the way down to T12 when you're looking at that thick raphe band, that thick connective tissue. Then it extends out to the bilateral shoulders. And when I say shoulders, it is attaching to the clavicle. It is attaching to the scapular spine. It's attaching to the acromion. On both sides. So you have this large muscle, and underneath that muscle, there is a lot of other muscles. I find that trapezial pain, yes, if it is a myofascial pain, can be a source of problems. Our trapezius are overworked and overused. But what about the levator scapula, which also attaches to the scapula, which attaches to the transverse process of the upper cervical spine. So when we talk about the trapezial pain, I think it's a good way of thinking, are we just talking about neck, posterior shoulder, and upper thoracic or even thoracic pain? And that area can be referred from the cervical spine, can be referred from the thoracic spine, can be referred from the scapula, can be referred from the shoulder. So that's why it's important for us as physicians to, you know, talk with the patient, get a little more history. So if we determine that, you know, we do our history, we do our physical exam, we determine that the patient with those two factors or with imaging, x-rays, MRIs, whichever, we determine they don't have a upper cervical radiculopathy or a mid-cervical radiculopathy. If they don't have facet-mediated pain, if they don't have facet arthritis or cervical spondylosis, if their problem is not purely just a shoulder, intra-articular shoulder problem, posterior shoulder problem, and it's truly myofascial pain, we're going to treat it the same way, obviously, as any pathology that we have in the neck. We start conservatively, right? So we do physical therapy, we do medication management as safe as possible for your patient. And then what happens if that doesn't work? And when I took, and I'm going to take one step back and go back to physical therapy, when I say, I'm going to use the word therapeutics instead. So physical therapy or chiropractic care or acupuncture. Now we know those things might have a lower level evidence to support for patients, especially depending on the chronicity of that pain, that myofascial pain, that can still, patients still respond. And there's such a low risk to doing some of these things that it's beneficial to do it. The reason I choose and most providers choose physical therapy is because physical therapy is not only trying to help decrease pain and improve posture and all this stuff, it provides you education to take after physical therapy is on. And you want to take that education, what you learned in physical therapy, hopefully at a good physical therapy facility, and take those education points and those postural points that they told you, or, you know, behavior modifications that they taught you, you want to include that for the rest of your life, because this, a lot of what myofascial pain is a chronic issue, an overuse issue. You got to change a lifestyle type of issue. It's almost, I think of it as losing weight. So physical therapy and all these other conservative measures are done first. But what happens when that fails? So you asked the question, your patient comes in, they want an injection. And I said, well, hold on. if it's nothing, if it's something that we think the most conservative treatments can help, let's do that. But when those things fail, or they still have the pain, or your patient is just like every other person in the world, where as much as we try to change those behaviors, those bad habits that we've done for years, and we have a hard time doing it, is there anything we can add on to that? And are there interventions for trapezial pain or posterior neck upper back, post-periscapular pain. Is there an intervention we can offer? And the answer is yes. The most common type of procedure that people think about would be either dry needling or trigger point injections. The difference between dry needling and trigger point injections is dry needling, you're using a non-bored needle, and you're trying to elicit a contraction into the muscles that you feel are tight or tender. It always works better if somebody actually has a true trigger point. But are you trying to elicit and try to cause further contraction and then relaxation of that muscle with the dry needling? I recently wrote a chapter in a book called Multidisciplinary Pain Disorder. Excuse me if I'm getting the name of the book that I wrote, the name of the chapter that I wrote. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name. That's so funny. But it's by Carl Ngo, and a lot of us contributed to this. And we talked about the evidence regarding dry needling and trigger points and stuff like that. But again, low-level evidence to support the use, depending on what you look at. But patients do benefit from dry needling. Therapists are certified. Some therapists can be certified, at least in the state of Texas. I know I can't talk about other states, but I know that in the state of Texas, therapists are certified to do dry needling. So I ask them to do that. When it comes to trigger points, I like the patient to have more than just a tender point. I like to have the trigger point. I want to see the contraction, feel that hypertonicity in the muscle. But with that, I'll use steroid. And sometimes I'll use lidocaine, more so lidocaine than not, a little bit of steroid. But when that fails, there is another injection that I like to do, and it's called a hydrodissection. So it's a trigger point, but a hydrodissection of the tissue planes of where the trapezius and the trapezial, the levator scapula, the splenius capitis, the serratus posterior superior actually kind of run. And I do these procedures with ultrasound. So I do my trigger point injections with ultrasound because I can hydrodissect where these nerve branches run. I can even see the dorsal scapular nerve and block that to kind of cause a relaxation of, say, the rhomboids. And then there is, and just because I didn't know this exists, I thought I was the only one in the world who thought the levator scapula was a very important part of patients' periscapular pain with referral to the lateral and posterior neck. I thought I was the only one, so I would always attack that. And I've had great results, even with or without steroid, doing triggering and injecting at its insertion site in the scapula. But there is a paper that was printed out, I think it was in the American Journal of Physical Medicine and Rehab. It was in 2019. A friend of mine said, sounds like you're doing something called the ultrasound guided 5-in-1 injection trigger point. And I laughed because I've been doing this since 2013, I think, when I learned it in fellowship. And what it is basically you're injecting, triggering at the trapezius muscle, the rhomboid, the levator scapula at the same time, the serratus posterior, all at that medial border of the scapula, and you're hydrodissecting, kind of releasing the tissue plane between those two muscles where the spinal accessory nerve branches run, and you can see them on the ultrasound, and also the dorsal scapular nerve. A simple injection at this site works beautifully. And I've had a lot of patients who've had relief from it who have failed to respond to medial branches when their cervical dynatomal pattern suggested that it was like a C5-6 or a C6-7. So that is probably my favorite injection to do. And I wish more people did it because, you know, I could benefit from it because that pain usually is brought on with chronic computer use and tech neck looking down all the time at a computer.
Great. Thank you. I had never heard of that injection, so I'm really glad that you shared it. And I hope that everyone listening here got that. You can always rewind the podcast if you need to listen to that again. And I don't know how many of our listeners are using ultrasound regularly in their spine clinics. What do you recommend for providers who don't currently use the ultrasound very much and want to feel more confident about it?
So if you want to use ultrasound, to learn how to use the ultrasound for diagnostic studies, I mean, like actually reading it, writing reports, that takes, you know, more time and dedication and training. And you can get a course, multiple courses for that. And it requires practice. To learn how to use it just for interventions and image guided injections, it's relatively easy. People who know how to drive a needle in the spine tend to know how to drive a needle with any type of image guidance. I don't think it's that hard. You learn simple techniques. So if you want to learn how to use ultrasound for these simple things, and I know in the beginning, it sounds like it's going to take you more time in your clinic, but after a few patients and you get it under your belt and you've done a course, it is relatively easy and you can do these type of procedures. If you want to do, you know, myofascial type treatment for your patients without using the ultrasound, the old techniques are proven and true. You know, trigger points were diagnosed. They think, what was it? I think it was like 1924 or something. So we knew the trigger points existed where the muscles get were type and hypertonicity and kind of, you know, they would be very tender and refer pattern. And what we've done in the past is just do blind injections. Those still work. And unfortunately, I have heard that, you know, for certain insurance companies that they are saying that certain types of these injections or trigger point injections, depending on where you're injecting, might be considered experimental, but they have been around for a long time. I think what people want to do is if they are doing these trigger point injections on a sequential basis, like you have them come in and do them like a series of them without steroid, obviously, or if you do them, I like it if my patients go get massages within a couple of days, or if they actually have some physical therapy going on, usually preferred physical therapy, that the physical therapy will work with them. Now that they're, if their pain has improved and they're actually able to move their neck a little bit more, then they can do more of those exercises. So I like to combine, you know, trigger point injections with other things as well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for all of your tips. We appreciate your time. Listeners, thank you for listening to this podcast. Dr. Enriquez, do you have anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
No, I just think that our field is great. We provide great relief for patients. And we do a lot of injections. I guess the one thing that I want to make sure that we all do is after the patient feels better, a lot of times we go in that room and they say, I'm pain-free or I feel much better, and we make it a quick visit. I say, give an extra couple of minutes to say, now that you're pain-free, let me tell you why this happened. Let's spend a little more time trying to make sure it doesn't come back. And that's where I feel if we can make that difference in patients and get them to try to change their behaviors, we would be more successful in the end in terms of treating pain.
That is excellent advice. I'm going to start trying to do that because I don't think I initially have thought about doing that, but I think that's a great tip.
Thank you.
All right. Bye, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.